spent some time talking again about the idea of being lukewarm. Is that right? Y'all had a discussion about it. We're going to go ahead and delve into chapter 5 a little bit today. And the chapter is entitled Serving Leftovers to a Holy God. And really, probably the meat of that idea is toward the end of it's toward the second half of the chapter. And we probably won't get into that a lot today. Probably Chris will take over that idea next week. But the idea of the chapter is, and I can't show the little video because the projector's upstairs, and so we'll just have to go with it today. But the idea of giving our best to God. What does God expect from us? The opposite of being lukewarm. We talked about the idea that sometimes we think about the concept of being lukewarm, as talked about in the book of Revelation, chapter 3. And we always make that application to everyone else. Well, such and such is not good enough, or they're not good enough. And a lot of times we don't look into our own lives and see, you know, maybe I am really not given everything I have. Maybe I am really given just the bare minimum to God in my service to Him, in my life to Him, and in my service to others. In this chapter, he opens it up where we kind of were in the last chapter, and he quotes from Revelation chapter 3, verses 15 through 18, and he says, "I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish that you were either one or the other. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth." Again, he emphasizes the idea of being disgusting to God. That the idea of spit here is more of an idea of vomit, or you know, it's not just a, you know, it's something that is so disgusting to you that you vomit it out. I don't need to go into more detail, do I? Then he says this: "You say I'm rich, I have acquired wealth, and do not need a thing. But you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, so that you can become rich, and white clothes to wear, that you can cover your shameful nakedness, and salve to put on your eyes, so that you can see." Is it possible? And again, he's not talking specifically to us, but we can certainly make the application. Is it possible that we can be so ingrained in the idea that we're okay, that we don't see how truly wretched we are? How truly, he says here, "You say I'm rich and I'm in need of nothing." And of course, I'm assuming he's speaking in physical terms there. And he says, "But look at yourselves from my perspective." And I think that's pretty hard really for us to do. To look at life, to look at us, to look at the church from God's perspective. Because we, you know, we see it in our own way. We see it in our own experiences, in our own perspective. But God says, "Here's what you see. I have everything I need. I'm rich. I'm sustained. I don't need anything else." And I guess you could go on to say, my eyesight's just fine. I have all the riches I need. I'm clothed." And God says this: "You don't realize that you're wretched, that you're pitiful, that you're poor, that you're blind, and that you're naked." Think about that. Have you ever had a dream that you are walking through a public place and you look down and you don't, you're not clothed? Anybody ever had that dream? Nobody? I guess it's just me. How does that feel?
Embarrassing.
It's embarrassing, right? And you're hoping it's a dream and you wake up and it's not true, right? A couple of times, Sean realized it wasn't a dream, and he was sleepwalking through the mall. And at camp this week, he came up to the cab, he came up to the dining hall, and he had no. That would be a horrible thing, wouldn't it? If that were real, you wake up and you're in cold sweats, and you're like, you know, what am I doing? I thought that I was, and then all of a sudden I end up in the middle of a public place, and I don't have any clothes on. That's kind of humorous, but imagine this. Standing before God, and you're not who you thought you were. The whole time you thought, I'm acceptable. I'm going to heaven. I've made it. I'm going to be there. I know. And then you stand before God and you say, well, I've got everything I need. And you look down and you don't have any clothes on, spiritually speaking. That's not going to be a good feeling. And the fact of the matter is, and I think we could all probably agree with this, that there's going to be a lot of people in that condition who, spiritually speaking, believe that everything is okay. That everything is hunky-dory in your spiritual life, and I don't need anything. I'm going along just fine. And if I die today, hey, everything is just great. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of people that are not in that condition. And here's the thing, though. We automatically say, well, there's all these denominations out there. And they don't have the truth, and they don't this, and they don't that. They worship this way and that way. But the fact is, we need to look inside, don't we? I need to look not outside. I need to look inside. I need to say, you know, am I really who God wants me to be? And I know we can't ever reach the pinnacle of who God wants us to be. But am I? Do I have the right concept? You know, I'm not nearly where I need to be, and I need to keep on striving and working and trying to be what God wants.
Who was the one people that Jesus berated the most? His harshest criticisms were not toward the sinners. It was the Pharisees, who proclaimed to be the religious leaders, who thought they were the ones who were the best that there could be in all of Judea. And he called them whitewashed sepulchres full of dead men's bones. You look good on the outside, but inside, it's nothing but a casket. You know, just call them vipers. You know, it was the one group of people who thought, oh, we're doing great. It's all those other people who have trouble. And he was the harshest on them than anybody. So you really have to be careful. You know.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great point, Rich. And he makes this statement in the book. He says, when you read this passage, do you naturally conclude that to be spit out of Jesus' mouth means you're a part of his kingdom? When you read the words wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, naked, do you think that he's describing saints? When he counsels them to buy white clothes to wear in order to cover their shameful nakedness, does it sound like advice for those that are already saved? You know, we know for a fact that who he's talking to is a body of Christians, right? A body of those who have been saved. We know that's the Church of Laodicea. And he talks about, all the churches in Revelation, the first part there that he's talking to, all of them have issues, right? All of them have problems. But all the rest, some of the rest, seem to be struggling with some moral issues and some other types of issues. But this is the only church that he says that I can't even stand you. I'm going to spit you out of my mouth because of your lukewarm attitude. He said the thing is, and I think this is part of being lukewarm, maybe, is being in a condition that is that way and not realizing it. Just going along status quo, thinking everything is fine. He says you can't see, you don't have any clothes on, spiritually speaking. You're pitiful, you're blind, you're poor, and you think you have it all together. And I think that idea, maybe, is very disgusting to God, just to come to the conclusion that we've made it, that we're there, and to know, God, that we're not. I think that's very difficult, maybe, that's exactly what he's referring to in this passage. I talked a couple weeks ago about, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I remember, about the parable of the soils. And is that the beginning of the lukewarm chapter, I think? Where he talks about the soils. He makes a statement. He says, for years I struggled with the parable of the soils. I wanted to know if the person represented the rocky soil is saved, even though he has no root. I then wondered about the thorny soil. Is this person saved, since he doesn't have any root? I doubt if people even considered these questions back in Jesus' day. Is this idea of the non-fruit-bearing Christian something that we have concocted in order to make Christianity easier? So we can follow our own course while still calling ourselves followers of Christ. So we can join the Marines, so to speak, without having to do all the work. Jesus' intention in this parable was to compare the only good soil to the ones that were not legitimate alternatives. I know a couple weeks ago, whenever it was that I thought last, I admitted that I was struggling with the idea of being thorny soil. Allowing the cares of the world to come in and to choke out not only the things that I try to do for God, but also the joy that we have. Also the peace and all the other great things that come along with being a Christian. We allow the cares of the world and the things of the world to come in and choke those things away. And what eventually happens is they take over. And he makes a statement here that to me is pretty telling. He says, there's one good soil, and the rest are not acceptable. And so if I'm not at least attempting to, as we talked about a few weeks ago, weed the garden, always keeping those thorns and those weeds and that bad stuff out, then I'm not going to be acceptable to God. And that's really a tough thing to think about for me. He uses a couple more verses there. He says, let's face it, we're willing to make changes in our lives only if we think it affects our salvation. This is why I have so many people ask questions like, can I divorce my wife and still go to heaven? Do I have to be baptized to be saved? Am I a Christian even though I'm having sex with my girlfriend? If I commit suicide, can I still go to heaven? If I'm ashamed to talk about Christ, is he really going to deny knowing me? These questions are tragic because they reveal much about the state of our hearts. It's like, what's the basic thing I can do and still go to heaven? Can I do something I know probably is not acceptable to God, and can I repent for that and still go to heaven? Our whole attitude, he says, is, and let's discuss this for a minute, is our attitude too much about what can I do, what's the things that I can do and still get to heaven? Or is it about my love and my relationship for God? What can I do in order to please God? What can I do in my life to be what he wants me to be instead of the very bare minimum so that I can... I remember in school, I was not a tremendous student. I made okay grades, but I still was not. I know that's surprising to Jerry. But I was not a tremendous student. I didn't enjoy classes. I didn't really enjoy studying, except for a few subjects, you know, lunch and recess. But those are my favorites.
Band,
I was up there. Yeah, I was an easy A+. But a lot of times my attitude in school was, what's the least I can do in order to make an A, or in order to make a B, or in order to pass, so I don't have to take the class again? Anybody ever fall into that category? I know Sean did. And he failed to make the mark a few times of the bare minimum, right? Things in high school were that way a lot, I think. You know, that's just a mentality of a high school student. Maybe some of you are not that way, and you were always wanting to study and make A's because you wanted to learn. Right? I know many of you are in that category, besides me. I know Mickey was.
I don't know why.
I don't know why, but anyway. Freak. Betsy was that freak. No, just kidding. Look how successful they are and how pitiful I am. But anyway. It sort of changed a little bit when you got to college, right? Because you were studying stuff mostly you were interested in, especially after the first couple years. But at some point, you got to get serious about learning to actually learn to put knowledge in your head, right? When you're trying to train for something, you don't want a doctor who's a brain surgeon working on your head who's one of these guys that just did the bare minimum in order to get through to be a brain surgeon, right? You want the guy that took it seriously and wanted to learn so that he could be the best that he could be as far as being a brain surgeon. It wasn't about the grade, right? It was about the learning. It was about what was supposed to be going into your head and into your heart so that you were actually training for the job. I told the story, I know, one of the first classes about Brandon Post and I taking a Spanish class together. And Brandon is one of these types that he is a sponge when it comes to learning. He loves to learn stuff. And he's a freak of nature. But anyway, he just takes, he absorbs everything in his head. And he'll just sit down and read a book on programming just because he can. Or about this or about that. And he knows a lot of things about certain things. Well, we took the Spanish class together, and I'm not that way. I was just kind of, I don't know why I took the class with him. He just asked me if I'd take the class with him. And so we went into the class, and I was just doing the very best I could to keep up with the homework. Just trying to get past. And it wasn't really, I don't even think they was for a grade. I don't remember. But I was just trying to make it through and learn some stuff, you know, just. But Brandon, by the end of the class period, he was speaking the new Spanish words with the teacher. You know, I'm just looking at him like, who are you? You know, are you an alien that's coming into your body? And all the people in the class, you know, they would come up to us after, you know, I'd be standing over there with him, you know, like, hey, we'd like to do a study session with you. And I'm like, okay, no, not you. Oh, Brandon. Oh. So I would sit there while Brandon studied with them. That's the type of attitude, though, I believe, that I struggle with as a Christian, too. Just trying to do whatever it takes to just make it. You know, as long as I'm in heaven, you know, that's good enough for me. You know, I can have the smallest shack in heaven and be fine. As long as I'm there. But it should be more about trying to please God. That in my relationship with God, That's what it's all about, is to try to please my Father in heaven because of my love for Him. And it's not about necessarily the reward I'm going to receive. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, we're all looking forward to that reward, and that is a part of it, definitely. But should that be our motivation for living for God? Because what usually happens, this is me, what usually happens is, if I'm only working for the reward, then I don't give the job that I should give. I don't do the work that I should do. I've worked jobs in my life, and I know you guys have too, that I didn't like. And the only reason I was working there was for what? The paycheck. And then you were disappointed in that when you got it, right? Because it wasn't as much as you wanted it to be. But you put up with all the junk, but you did just, sometimes you would do just enough not to get in trouble, you'd just do whatever it took to get through the week so you could get to the end of the week and get the paycheck. Not many people are going to succeed in their jobs with that kind of attitude, are they?
Isn't that an interesting concept, though? It is, you would put in just enough effort to get by so they wouldn't fire you. And then when they paid you, you were disappointed at what they gave you, which was more than you deserved.
Well, that's not always true.
Well, I mean, it is, because they hired you to do a job, and you did the least amount of work instead of trying to excel at the job, and then we're disappointed with the result that we get. It's kind of like, how do we expect to get more out of life when we don't want to put anything into it? Mm-hmm. It's the same way with God. How do we expect, because we accept grace and say, well, He's going to forgive me, we think we can get by because all of the effort's on His end. Which is true. But He does anticipate and expect that because of that grace, we're going to react to Him. Because we know we've been given such a great gift that we will respond in such a way to say, you know, I can't help but be overjoyed by it. But because it's a delayed reward, which we always have trouble with, you give me an immediate reward, I react. You promise me something later,
I have a struggle with that.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I got to work really hard, and you can give me something. Yeah. And that's tough.
Have you been to a restaurant, and it was obvious the person hated their job? Fast food restaurant or somewhere, and you go into the counter, and it's obvious the person hates their job. They're doing it just to get by. And then there's the person that works the same job that's obvious that they love their job. Right? And they are nice to you and they smile at you and they say, welcome to McDonald's or welcome to wherever. We're so glad that you came in today. And they get it. You know, and they're there because they, I don't know if it's they love people or they love the actual job. Or I mean, there are people that love to work at McDonald's. There are people that love it. There are people that you go in and they're like, what do you want? You know, and they're slow and they don't know what they're doing and they haven't trained themselves to be. And I mean, it's an obvious difference. And here's the question for us. Do people around us, can they tell the difference? About whether we're just going through the motions as a Christian, about whether we are we're in that condition of just being meeting the minimum requirements of doing whatever it is, or can they tell an obvious difference between those of us who are joyful about being a Christian, who are really plugged into it, who are really doing the things that we do, not because we're trying to meet some quota or have some or get some reward at the end, but because we are actually plugged in and love what we do, and love who we do them for. You know, the thing about it is, in any relationship that lasts for a long time, that relationship should grow, right? That relationship should flourish over time and should get deeper and should the love that exists should grow. I know I've known Sean for a long time, and our relationship has changed a lot over the course of, how long has it been? 20 years almost. When I met him, he was 15. He was a little punk kid.
Had that one.
Okay. He was no, that's pretty much right. What?
I was generous.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, started out and we had this youth minister student relationship. And Sean mentioned this the other night in his class at camp. And over the course of time, we became friends, and then we became, he was kind of my assistant at one point, and now we're considered co-workers, and I consider Sean one of my best friends, even though he's a lot younger than me. But the relationship of two people, it's the same in the marriage relationship. Let's see, who's our youngest, Betsy and Johnny, who's our youngest married couple? Who's our oldest married couple in here? Rich Judy in here, but that says something right there. All of our older couples, you know, they're not even in here, but Eric's not here, and Rich and Becky's not in here, so, you know, whatever. But, so we can go to class and split and not be a big deal, but no. How hard was it, Betsy, this week for you to be apart from Johnny? Very difficult. This was their first time apart for a week, as a whole week. Now they get to take a European vacation, you know, to make up for it. With a group of teenagers, which is not really a good thing, but,
You take them when you get them.
Yeah, exactly. But they get the bridal suite everywhere they go in Europe, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But for them, their relationship is at a very early state, right? And it's very, for Betsy to be away from Johnny, you know, it was very difficult. And I'm sure it was the same for Johnny. Such for Johnny? Mm-hmm. It was. But the older and the more you mature in your relationship, you know, you still miss the person. It's still difficult to be apart from them, but it sort of changes and your relationship grows. I'm afraid with God, though, maybe our relationship doesn't grow as it should. I mean, I think I've been a Christian since I was 12. 30 years I've been a Christian. And I wonder, has my relationship with God grown as much as my relationship with my wife, which I've been married for 20 years? I know that relationship has grown a lot, yes.
But I think there's something for remaining a Christian for all those years. Of course, you're going to grow, but staying faithful and strong. And of course, as we grow older, we see things from a different perspective anyway. So maybe it hasn't grown, the relationship like you wanted or we wanted, but staying a Christian and being strong in that, it's a big part of it. I mean, I cannot just go through life thinking, oh, this is awful, I'm not closer to God. We should always want to be closer, but it's a joyful experience. It's not a depressing thing that, oh, I'm not going to have the same kind of home in heaven like this other person who does missions all night long. And the effort of keeping the relationship is still there.
Okay, that's a good point, and that's actually pretty close to the point that he makes in the book. The next little section he spends talking about, he's not saying these things to discourage us in our relationship with God, because we understand that, you know, God's grace, just like Rich said, God's grace is sufficient, and it will cover us. It does help us to maintain that relationship. But also, we can't go. It's like extremes, right? I can't depend totally on God's grace, but I also can't depend totally on myself either. So it's kind of the, you know, it's more of a middle ground, and I think you're definitely right that maintaining a relationship is a very positive thing. But what would happen if in a marriage relationship your relationship never grew from the time you were married until the time you have your 50th wedding anniversary?
You wouldn't have the 50th.
Okay, that's exactly right. Okay, that's exactly it. The relationship at some point, It has to naturally grow if the love continues to grow. And if the love doesn't continue to grow, then the relationship will not continue. The thing is, we always see it from our perspective. All right? I've known, and I don't know how this is even possible, but I've known people who, in a marriage relationship, just all of a sudden out of the blue, one of the spouses comes up and said, "I want a divorce. I don't love you anymore." Got a friend, a good friend going through that right now. He has no clue. Now the question is, was it all of a sudden, or did he just not recognize it? See, I can't make that call because I don't really know. But I have a feeling it wasn't all of a sudden. You don't just all of a sudden stop loving somebody that I know of. So over the course of time, his love, the love she had for him, was sufficient for him. But the love that he had for her was not sufficient for her for whatever reason. And I'm not excusing it, because I definitely think that it could be bad. It could be her fault too. I'm just saying, is that the way sometimes though, that is that the way maybe that our relationship with God could be? That the love that he has for me is sufficient, and that I can live for the rest of my life on whatever God gives me. But what about the reverse of that? And I think that's exactly where this church in Laodicea was. They were plugging along, and they were growing as a church. They were, you know, they were, I don't know, had all sorts of things going on, I guess. They thought evidently God was blessing them because they were wealthy. But obviously, from God's perspective, what they were giving him was not enough. It was not enough of their life and not enough of their heart. He makes a statement in the book that I want to, it's about time to quit, that I want to close with, before you think about it. If I can find it. Say it about the way he said that this is really good. Basically, what he says is that with God, I know it's right after this, it's right in here somewhere. He says that with God, he demands all or nothing. Is that true? God demands all or nothing. What do you think? Think about this passage here. He says, this is Matthew 16:24-25. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. Any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. And I think we find verses like that all throughout the New Testament, that being a disciple, being a follower of God, is more than just meeting God halfway. It's more than just, God, you give me some and I'll give you some and we'll be good. It's because of what you've given me, God, I'm going to give you everything back. I'm going to respond to you in a way that says everything I have is yours, and I'm going to give up my life. I'm going to give up my family. I'm going to give up whatever I have to give up in order to be a disciple of Christ, in order to be your follower. He makes a statement too somewhere in here, and I think it's a little bit later, where he says, "If you were asked to give up your job for God, would you do it? If you were asked to give up your spouse for God, would you do it? If you were asked to give up your home, if you were asked to give up the things that you possess for God, would you do it? Or would you choose those things over Him?" And the statement that he makes about spitting out of his mouth, he said, the reason that he thinks maybe that the word spit and vomit out of your mouth is used is that God is disgusted at the fact that we would even dare to choose the things of this world on an equal footing, on an equal standing with Him. Would we dare choose the things of this life, no matter what they are, over God? Would we dare put them on an equal standing, on an equal footing with the God of the universe? That those things that He created could even be anywhere near the Creator, we understand is not the truth. But yet, so many people, though, they choose the things of this life over their Father in heaven. And that's the challenge for us, is to stay above that, to be willing. And we may not ever be asked to do that. We may not ever be asked to give up our own life, to give over all of our possessions, to whatever. But we have to have the attitude that there is. That anything in my life that I have to give to God, I'll give. That anything in my life that, I mean, it's God's already, and I have to understand that. And the attitude of being of this idea of being lukewarm is something that's very dangerous, I think, in all of our lives. And we just need to take a look at it in our own life. Next week we're gonna pick up, Chris will pick up in the book where it talks about how rich we really are. He gives some pretty startling statistics in the book about how rich. That's a tongue twister. How rich we really are. How rich we really are compared to those in the world. We look at ourselves, and even the poorest of us are so wealthy compared to those around the world. And how that idea of being rich and not realizing it, or maybe not acknowledging it, has really affected the way that we view God and view our own life, our own Christianity. Any other questions or comments? Got a couple more minutes.
Well, I guess the richer we are, the less we depend on God. And I guess it is in other countries. Those that are open to God are more open to God and eager because they need Him for tomorrow's meal or whatever. Here it's we're all rich, although we might not think so.
Sean gives the agreeing nod. Still good.
He went to a verse last week, and he quoted it in the book from Jeremiah, where God said, "You were hungry, and I fed you. You were satisfied, and you forgot me. Mm-hmm. When you were hungry, you wanted me, so I gave you what you needed. And as soon as you were satisfied, you turned your back on me." Because as soon as we realize we have everything we need, suddenly we did it. When we have nothing, we have nowhere to turn. Anything that happens to us, we know God did something for us. But when we have the ability and we think we did it, then we take all the credit and we just don't give it to Him.
Well, and it's not only that we think we did it, it's also that
we deserve.
We're satisfied.
Yeah.
You know, once we get satisfied, then we don't really. It's like, you know, I'm sure he was referring in Jeremiah to the children of Israel. You know how they begged God for bread, and so God sent the bread. Well, then they got satisfied by that, and they wasn't good enough for them, so they claimed they needed meat. then they needed this, and they needed that, and as soon as God satisfied them, and then they forgot about him. Turned somewhere else.
When you think of Hannah, and we've been studying about her in 1 Samuel, but the only thing she wanted, I mean, the one thing she wanted was just to have a boy, a baby boy. And she promised that if he just gave her a boy, she would give that boy to him for all the days of his life. You know, and I think we would be tempted, once we receive whatever that was that we were praying so hard for, thanks, see ya, you know, and that'd be it. But she didn't. I mean, she got the one thing that was on her heart. She had begged and begged for. And she turned him over forever to God. I mean, that's hard to do. But you want to talk about someone who is willing to do exactly what you're talking about, give up everything.
At probably 3 years old.
As soon as he was weaned, I think, she gave him up. And he lived with Eli. Grew up with him. I think she came once a year, something like that, to see him.
Brought him a new coat every year.
And that was... We can't imagine doing that today, I think. But he answered her prayer, and she kept her word.
Actually, his name was the very answer to the prayer.
So for us, the analogy is that we pray for the salvation of God, and if he'll give it to us, we'll give him our life. And do we really do it? He gives it to us, and well, heaven's mine because I was baptized, and now I can, you know, meet some minimum requirements, and now I'm going to be in heaven. You know, and that's, Hannah loved her son, but not more than God. And that's the challenge for us. Chris, I don't want to give up some of his stuff next week, but we'll finish that. Chris will be teaching next week. I won't be here. I'll be in Dallas.
Hopefully.
What do you mean, hopefully?
Then they just get back in camp.
Yeah. Well, they have this week off.
Most of the same kids, huh?
A lot of the same time. Well, this week we got the day camp. Yeah, that was all the younger kids. So
last week,
this coming week, we go to day camp. We're going to break the ground.
11 more hours.
You guys are doing well.
Oh, that's your baby milk. My little girls had one of those until it turned yellow.
That was a good joke.
Throw it away. No! Yeah.